So, Act 7. I just want to focus to start with on Abraham, because, you know, look to Abraham, the rock from which you were hewn, Abraham, the father of the faithful. The impression can be given that there was Abraham living there in Ur of the Chaldees, and God appears to him and says, leave everything, go to a land that I will show you. And he says, yes, sir, and off he goes. And, you know, he's a wonderful example. And yes, he was a wonderful example, but that is not, I think, the full story. Because, okay, it says here, verse 2, the God of glory appeared to our father Abraham while he was in Mesopotamia, before he lived in Haran, and said to him, leave your land and your kindred, that is your family, and go into the land which I will show you. And then he left the land of the Chaldeans and dwelt in Haran, blah, blah. As if, oh yeah, God said, oh no, he did it. But that is not actually the case. Because when you go back to Genesis chapter 12, God tells him when he's in Ur to leave. And to not leave not only Ur, but to leave his family. And he does not leave his family. He goes with his father and with Lot, and they travel together. In fact, in Genesis 11, verse 31, Terah took Abraham, his son, and they went from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. That's different. God told Abraham, leave your family and leave your land. And it seems he doesn't. His father takes him, who he's supposed to have separated from, and says, look, let's leave here. That could have been for any number of reasons. There could have been a war, there could have been whatever. His father does this, and they come to Haran, and they live there. And it's only when Abraham's father dies, verse 32 of Genesis 11, it's only when Terah, his father, dies that they move on. Well, God had told him, leave Ur, and I will take you to a land that I will show you. Well, he doesn't just get up and go. His father takes him and says, no, we're going to live in Haran. This is not the land of promise. And he doesn't leave there until his dad dies. And there is evidence from outside the Bible, it's not specifically recorded in the Bible, as far as I know, that in those times, Haran was being invaded by various tribes. So it's probably a good thing to get out anyway. And a lot of people were fleeing anyway, so, all right, so I'll do that. I'll do what everyone else is doing. I'll run away as well. And then, of course, he took Lot with him. He was told to separate from all his family. And as you probably remember, him and Lot then have a bit of an argument because they get so wealthy that their animals, there's not enough pasture for them. And then Abraham says to Lot, look, what are we going to do? Let's not argue. Where do you want to go? And Lot says, well, I'm going to go and live over there in the valley. And Abraham says, okay. So they had to separate. Him and Lot had to separate because their herdsmen were arguing with each other and nearly fighting each other. So again, his separation from his family was brought about by God, by providence, you might say, by some sort of higher hand, operating, rather than him simply obeying. And this is, I think, perceived by Stephen back here in Acts 7, verse 4. Then he left the land of the Chaldeans and lived in Haran, and from there, when his father was dead, God sent him into this land. Well, I think sent is a poor translation. The idea, as I understand from the Greek, is God removed him, and I believe the King James actually says that. God moved him. So this is not Abraham saying, oh sure, you told me to leave, I'm going, sir. No. God moved him. And why would Stephen be emphasizing the apparent weakness of Abraham? Well, because he's answering the Jews who are saying, like, we are the people, we are the true people. God's presence is only in the temple. and you then think about having Gentiles involved, blah, blah. He's saying, look, the God of glory appeared to Abraham when he was out there in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abraham was, in fact, not a wonderful example exactly of faith. It's not due to ethnic purity that you Jews are right with God. And likewise, he is going to go on to say that God likewise appeared to Moses in the bush, out in the desert. It's not in the Jerusalem temple. And this idea that actually it was God who kind of made Abraham respond, you get it picked up a couple of times. If you like to have a look at Genesis 20, well, you don't have to look it up, I'll read it. Genesis 20, 13. This is when Abraham, now with some more maturity, is looking back on his life. It happened when God caused me to wander from my father's house. God caused me to wander from my father's house. Now, the impression that you get is God appeared to this random guy in Ur of the Chaldees and said, leave your family, leave your house, leave your land, and go to a land that I will show you. But actually, God caused him to wander from there. God made him. There were push factors that were arranged by God. And if, well, you look it up, or I'll read it to you from Joshua 24, verse 3. God says, I took your father Abraham from beyond the river and led him throughout all the land of Canaan. I took your father Abraham. Or, as Stephen puts it, God removed him. Putting all the evidence together, it seems that Abraham got the call, but he was not that responsive to it. Certainly not in terms of leaving his family. And God caused him, that's the bit I like, when he says, God caused me to wander from my father's house. God made me, caused me to be obedient to this. And so we have each received the call of the gospel. But let's not think that we sit here at a Bible study or breaking bread or church or whatever, because we understood the Bible and we, with our own steel will, responded to it. There is a far bigger hand in the reason why we are all at the point we are in our spiritual journey, and it is not in our own strength. It is not purely that God simply picked us up and forced us, because then we would only be puppets, and God doesn't want puppets. So we are not puppets, but we are also not strong-willed Bible students who read the Bible, and I do what I read there, blah, blah. This is not how it is. It is of grace. And so when we're told, look to Abraham, your father, the rock from whence you are hewn, he is the father of us all, the father of the faithful. Yes, this is so. But in the sense that he is an example of grace, he is an example of somebody who was not so strong, being almost, and I say almost, almost forced to be obedient. Now, it has to be of grace, or else otherwise our whole path to God's kingdom is of glorification of steel will and ability to understand. You think of the man we just baptized, Syed, when you think that he came from Iran, and you think of the journey that he's had physically and spiritually to get to the point of baptism. Well, that was not simply because he had the strength of mind to read Bible basics and get baptized and so forth. Who would not deny that there was something there? There's something from his side, but also this is quite clearly God's grace, the movement of God's grace. So then God caused him. God caused Abraham to leave his father. And so I think that if God caused Abraham, he likewise will do that with us. Now, this could have been through putting an idea in his head, through raising up persecution for him, through thinking that life was actually going to be better in Haran rather than in Ur. Could have been all sorts of things. But to sum it up in a single word, it is the Spirit. And when Paul starts talking about predestination, foreknowledge, all this kind of stuff in Romans, he doesn't think, oh yeah, I've just wrote to these gents about predestination and foreknowledge, and we just start talking about it out of the blue. Why he talks about foreknowledge and predestination is to underpin his argument that salvation is by grace and not of works. And he's saying that the biggest evidence that we're saved by grace and not works is this higher hand in our lives. Because a lot of us here, myself included, I came to Christ, if you like, because we were born into families that believed. That's as simple as that. And then you think, well, what happens if all the guys are born into Muslim families, atheist families, blah, blah. Yeah, this is grace. And actually, those like myself who were born, if you like, into it, or into believing families, we can often sort of feel a bit second class compared to the guy we just baptized an hour ago who was born into a Muslim family who moved right across the spectrum. And when I meet people like that and they give their story, I always say to them, oh, well, my story isn't very exciting. My mum and dad were believers and you know, so on. Well, no, that is just as much the movement of God's grace, if you like, almost on an even bigger level. Because what's the chance of that, of being born into a believing family? If you look at a historical perspective, that I was not born in the rainforests of Brazil 3,000 years ago, I was not born into a Chinese family 5,000 years ago, you know, we were born to believers at this point in history and time and space. This is so fluky. And it's not fluky. This is God's grace. So don't think that you're kind of second class because you don't have an amazing testimony, as it were, that you were, born into this situation and you got out of it and you changed 180 degrees. It's all of grace. And so God wants us to be saved. And this is the whole flow of the argument here, that it is all of grace. So then, Abraham was a good guy. No question about that. I'm not saying he was nobody. But it was that his faith was confirmed. Now, this idea of being weak in faith and yet strong in faith is, I think, repeated a little bit later on when you read about Moses. Now, if we go on reading about Moses, verse 28 and 29, Moses thinks that he's doing the right thing, trying to save this Israelite from abuse by an Egyptian. And then the next day, the guy says, are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian yesterday? And Moses fled at this saying and went to live in the land of Midian. In the Exodus record, it says that Moses feared greatly when he heard this. And he ran away to Midian out of fear. But when you come to Hebrews 11, we are told, we're given a totally different slant on this. We're told that Moses, by faith, this is Hebrews 11:27, by faith he forsook Egypt, not fearing the anger of the king, for he endured because he saw him who is invisible. So, why did he run away from Egypt? Well, Hebrews 11 says he did this by faith, not fearing the anger of the king. Exodus states that he did flee, fearing the anger of the king, and Acts 7 seems to imply that, yes, it was out of fear that he ran away, but it says here that he ran away in Hebrews by faith, and not frightened of the king. That is not a contradiction. It'll be facile to say, there you are, the Bible contradicts itself. The Bible doesn't. The Bible is profound. This is something we should all quite easily relate to, that you can believe and yet disbelieve at one and the same time. That is the nature of our human being, our human nature, the way we are wired, whichever way you want to put it. Obviously, that man who comes to Jesus and says, Lord, I believe, but help my unbelief. Well, he says it in so many words. I believe, but I don't believe. And this is something that worries people when they come to baptism and afterwards, do I really believe? I was talking to someone about baptism this week who said, I don't know whether I really believe. Because I think sometimes I do and I think sometimes I don't. And I quoted these examples I've just given you. That is unfortunately our human nature, that we, belief and unbelief can coexist, unfortunately. It did in Moses, and it did in that man who said, Lord, I believe, to help my unbelief. So then, it's the same with Abraham. Did he believe? Yes, he did. Did he also have unbelief and lack of response? Yes, he did. Now, it's very easy to see this in other people. Unfortunately, because we all tend to be rather critical of others. But it's, just look inside yourself and you see it. We are such a mixture. And I suppose it is that the side of faith and spirituality that has got to become the dominant side, so that that is who I really am, who I really identify with. It should teach us patience with others in their weakness, because they also have another side to them. They are not simply, you know, weak, unspiritual people. So then, Moses is like that. You have another example, I think, in Peter, in the first letter of Peter, when he talks about, we won't look it up, but when he talks about Sarah and says, oh yeah, Christian wives should take a message, a lesson from Sarah, who obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. You know the passage? Well, Deb was like shaking her head like, what? Does the Bible say that? Yes, my dear, the Bible does say that. Okay. O ye of little faith, it is there. Have you found it, Weena?
I haven't found it yet.
That's 1 Peter chapter 3.
Chapter 3, verse 6.
As Sarah, for after this manner in the past, the holy women who trusted in God also made themselves beautiful by submitting to their husbands. As Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose children you now are, if you do well and are not put in fear by any terror. So, Peter quotes this example of Sarah calling Abraham my Lord, and he says, now come on, that's how women have got to treat their husbands.
Read on.
No, wait a minute. Listen on, my dear. When exactly does Sarah call Abraham my Lord? It's when she is 90 years old and Abraham is 99 and the angels appear to Abraham and said, Abraham, you and your wife are going to have a child. And Abraham was impotent. Right? Because Romans 4 says he did not consider the deadness of his own body, nor the deadness of Sarah's womb. So, right, he's impotent, she's, you know, past it. And the angels appear on God's behalf and say, you and your wife are going to have a child. And it says that Sarah, in her heart, laughed and said, shall I have such pleasure? My Lord, being old also. And then the angel comes to her and says to Abraham, says, why did Sarah laugh? He said, oh, I didn't laugh. And the angel said, yes, she did laugh. So when does she call Abraham my Lord? In her heart. And frankly, you know, to put it like straight up, she's in her heart, she's thinking, huh, shall I have such pleasure, my Lord being old also? That is sarcasm. She's saying, he can't even get it up. Shall he, my Lord, do this as if angel of God? And that's why the angel is cross with her and says, you shouldn't have laughed. It's, oh, I didn't laugh. Oh, wow, it's an angel. Trumps. No, I didn't laugh. Yes, she did laugh, Sarah. So this is not exactly Sarah at her best. And it's a snapshot that's taken. And Peter takes a snapshot and he says, but focus on the positive. She called Abraham my Lord. Now, what a good example to all of you. See what I'm saying? That she said it in sarcasm. She said it in weakness of faith. And yet, God is so positive and says, look, she called him Lord. There you go, girls. Call your husband's lord. Now, another example of being positive, and it's again about poor old Sarah. I've got nothing against Sarah, really, but, you know, she was a bit like she was. It's in Galatians, when we're told, and in Romans, when we're told that the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. And that's quoted as scripture. But when she said that, she was being absolutely beastly to Hagar and her child Ishmael. And she says to Abraham, chuck this woman out, because the son of the servant girl shall not be heir with my son, Isaac. And she chucks her out with just a little bit of water in a flask, or in a, like a leather thing, I guess, you know, like a balloon or something.
Bladder.
Yeah, so they get out in the desert, and Ishmael is about to die, and Hagar says, like, literally says, oh my God, may I not see the death of my own child. And then the angel appears and says, don't worry. Opens her eyes, shows her the well of water, and says, don't worry, Ishmael shall also live, and he shall also be a nation, blah, blah. But my point is, when she chucks Hagar out, effectively to her death, you know, it's like to tell in the desert there to say, you go out there and die. That's basically saying, here's a flask of water, you know, here's a can of water, go out there. You're going to die. And that kid, she knew that they were going to die. She wanted to kill her. She was angry with her. And Abraham was too weak. He should have been stronger and said, no, dear, you know, we're not going to do that. The kid's going to die, right? But those words, when she's storming and bitching, really, at Hagar, the son of the slave girl shall not be heir with my son, even Isaac, that is picked up and quoted as scripture. So, what I'm saying is this, that God is very positive. And it's a real exhortation to me, because I'm terribly cynical. And I think we all have a tendency that way. John and Edwina, by the way, sorry, not embarrassing, but I mean, they're a wonderful example of positivity. Really are. Yeah, even you. Don't be wide-eyed and innocent. But that's really how it is. You know, Cindy's an example of positivity. I better say you're all examples of being positive, because otherwise you think, oh, so he doesn't think I'm positive. No, right. You're all examples of being positive, right? What I'm saying is, I think I have a tendency, which we all have, to not being positive. But if you look at how what I call this snapshotting, where God snapshots people, like Sarah thinking in her heart, sure, my Lord, do this. And says, oh yeah, she called him Lord. Jolly good. Or in the middle of this SPAC attack with Hagar, chucking her out to her death, which if God hadn't intervened is what it would have been, and the child, and saying, oh, those words she said are scripture. You know, God is so positive. All the way through, even though in Galatians, I mean, when it says Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael. No. Abraham didn't have two sons. Abraham had a load of kids. By Keturah and, you know, honestly, who knows who.
Seven.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's the ones you know about. I mean, yeah, a bunch of kids. Genesis 25, yep, a bunch of them. It's just written there, by Keturah and his concubines. So the whole presentation that dear old Abraham had two sons, Isaac and Ishmael, it's true. If you want to look at it that way, it is true. He did have two sons. But the implication is he only had two sons. He didn't say that, but that's how it's framed. God is so positive. So positive. And this is what...
saying that Adam and Eve had three children.
Yeah, or that Noah had three sons who were saved.
Mm.
Well, yes, but he probably had a whole load of other kids. And it would be a bit odd that Shem, Ham and Japheth and their wives between them never produced any kids. I'm sure they did. So, you know, it's all very positively framed. Now, this is not to say that God is naive or that God is, you know, turns a blind eye and so forth. Not at all. I go on this track talking about faith and unbelief existing within people such as Moses and Abraham, and how God focuses upon the positive. And this is really, I think, what love does, because imputation of righteousness, which, you know, Paul's on about it in Romans, isn't he? That he counts as righteous. This is love, is it not? That love is not blind, that is not true. But love sees the positive and imagines and exaggerates the positive. And that is put in theological terms by Paul when he says God imputes righteousness. He counts us as if we're righteous. That's why you talk to the, I don't know, the good, upright young brother who's about to marry a hopeless druggie and alcoholic. You say, look, mate, can't you see what it's going to be like? Do you not see what she's doing? Oh, yeah, I see it. Yeah, okay. But he sees her very positively.
And Hosea.
Hosea, exactly. Hosea and Gomer, the prostitute and the prophet. And, of course, that old thing, thank you for that, we know. I mean, because that is, you know, that's a great example, Hosea. Of positivity, in a sense, the positivity that comes from love. Now, I mean, Hosea also got real mad with Gomer. He talks about killing her and stripping her naked and leaving her to die and all this kind of stuff. And yet he, in the end, loves her passionately. And, of course, his love for her is the love of God towards Israel and towards us. So there are some thoughts. Just very randomly arising out of Acts 7. And this sort of thing should affect us practically, because we're all faced with difficult people, difficult situations, and it's very easy to put everything in black and white. She's a wonderful person. He's awful. You know, no one is totally wonderful and no one is totally awful. And yet, in the end, the love that triumphs in all this is the love that sees positively. You know, we don't want to be like America or whatever, sort of boiling everyone down to goodies and baddies and cowboys and Indians and, you know, who's the goodies and who's the baddies. Life is more nuanced than that. And our own lives and spirituality is more nuanced than that. Far more nuanced. Yet we have the comfort that he knows our frame and he knows our wiring better than we do ourselves. And this is the challenge to respond in the same way as God sees us. Now, we read Romans 6 of the baptism earlier, or looked at it, and Paul says a wonderful thing there when he says, in the context of baptism, count yourselves dead to sin. And it's the same word for impute that he's going to go on to use, or has used already in Romans, about God imputing no sin to us. And he says, look, do that to yourselves. See yourselves how God looks at you. And, of course, see other people in the same way. And this is what faith is all about in its final term. Faith is about believing that he loves me and I really will be in God's kingdom. Despite all my unbelief, despite all my weakness, and this is not in any sense to justify poor behavior, failure, and so forth, not in any sense to justify any of that, but we shall be saved. And that is the good news, and that's why the good news of the gospel is so hard to believe, that I shall really be saved, that I shall really live forever, that if the Lord comes now, I can positively say that by grace I will be in his kingdom. Well, yes, because anything less than that is not good news. It's very worrying news that I am now responsible to judgment, and I've got to answer for myself, and let's hope maybe I'll be saved. That's not good news. How can you have all joy and peace through believing if at the end of your destiny, at the end of the path of life, you have this big question mark. Shall I be saved? No idea. This is awful. This is not the good news. But of course it cuts the other way, that if this is true, that I really am going to live forever by his grace, that it is all wonderfully true and I believe it. This is what faith and belief is really all about. If you really believe that, well, life cannot be the same. Then you are going to find the strength to talk to other people, to give them that hope, to try what you can to pull people back who have known the faith, who are wandering away from it. It's going to motivate you to get out there and talk to folks. It's going to motivate you in your own life, self-control, and of course, particularly in the huge mountain of forgiveness, which seems at times such a mountain too high and too hard to climb for all of us. But if I'm going to be there when I should not be there, what can I do? This is where we find energy in spiritual life. Because you can't keep motivating yourself by fear. You can't keep motivating yourself by some human being, no matter how well-meaning, saying, come on, we should do this. Come on, you should be doing that. All this only lasts for so long. The abiding motivation is that I believe that I will be saved. That if Jesus comes now, I will live forever. And this is the good news of the gospel. And this is why people don't believe it, because it demands too much. There's a psychology, I think, to disbelief. And it's because it's too good. It's too good news. And so often the whole thing about belief and faith gets pushed back to what I'd call apologetics. Do we believe in God? Do we believe in the Bible? This is all beyond that. All that becomes taken as read once you believe in salvation in Jesus. Anyway, we've rather wandered. Anyway, over to you folks to...